Well, we're kind of working through our missions month, so if you're new here and you wonder, hey, do they watch a video like that every week? No, we don't. We're trying to get a good handle on the missionaries. We have about 36 missionaries and mission organizations that we support, and we want to try to get a handle on what they're doing, where they're at, and how things are going, so we see some of those. I like the little hut or cabin over here on my right and the little wash bin. Matt's dirty underwear is... Don't go up and look. It's kind of gross. But this is to promote sending a Wichel kid $5. And if you haven't done that, on the back, there's some pink envelopes that you can grab. And maybe grab two or three or four, and you can send some kids to camp. $25 a kid. So I just want to promote that again. I think it would be great if we could send all, let's see, it's 132 kids I think we want to send to camp this year through that. So it would be great if we could do that. But it also reminds me that there have been men and women throughout the years that have gone on the mission field. They have served the Lord, and they have inspired hundreds and thousands of people that come after them by their example. In the early church, there would be people with funny names like Polycarp and Ignatius and Irenaeus. And they wrote and they inspired a passion for Jesus. Later on, there were people like Augustine and Origen and Athanasius that wrote and they modeled and they led people and they inspired people to continue on with Christ. Now, in my favorite time of Christian history, the Reformers, Jan Hus, William Tyndale, Martin Luther would be those that just inspired people. And there's, you know, that was 500 years ago, but there are still people talking about what these guys wrote and what these guys model and still want to be like them. So all, you know, throughout all these years and throughout all the centuries, there have been men and women that have done this. Now, one of my personal favorites that I talk about from time to time is Hudson Taylor. And if you haven't read that book, Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret, put it at the top of your reading list for 2019 and read that book. It's a great book, not only for the challenge, but in this month of missions, it's a great book that talks about what he called his secret. Secret to a spiritual life, secret to finding peace and strength. So what happens in the book is they introduce the idea that there's this big secret, but then you got to read the whole book to get to the last chapter to find out what the secret really is. They entice you in that way. Now, I don't have time this morning. I was going to read some of excerpts from that book, but I do want to read one. He wrote, "To let my loving Savior work in me his will, my sanctification is what I would live for by his grace. Abiding, not striving nor struggling, looking off unto him, trusting him for power, resting in the love of an almighty Savior, in the joy of complete salvation from all sin. This is not new, yet 'tis new to me. Christ literally all seems to me now, the power, the only power for service, and the only ground for unchanging joy." So you get all the way through this book, and he's got all these great things, and it's like every chapter you come to, you're like, oh, next chapter, oh, it's great. You get to the last chapter, and he begins to talk about his secret. What's the secret to a spiritual life? What's the secret to finding a way of looking at life that would take somebody like Hudson Taylor from England all the way to China? And in the last chapter, he says this about his secret. He wrote, "The simple, profound secret of drawing for every need, temporal or spiritual, upon the fathomless wealth of Christ." That's his big secret. So you look at that, and I just want to say that it looks really good on the screen. Sounds really good to say. But then you got to realize Hudson Taylor buried four of his kids in China. Buried two wives in China. One literally lost her mind because of the stress of living there. He was thrown in prison. He was questioned. He was destitute. He was homeless. He ultimately died after 52 years in China. So it's one thing to say it. It's a whole other thing to realize that Hudson Taylor lived it. And so you look at Taylor's life, and you look at how he spent his life. He died penniless. He died with nothing to leave his kids. And when you look at his life, you either conclude that he wasted his life or his life was worth all of the effort. And I want to ask you today, and I want to challenge you to think about, was it a waste or was it worth it? Was it a waste or was it worth it? And you're going to draw a conclusion, kind of your perspective, based upon your beliefs and your convictions and how you see life. But these are all going to come into play on whether or not you believe he wasted his life or if it was all worth it. Danielle and I, as we were raising money to go to Paraguay, we had kind of one of these weird moments where we were challenged with that same idea. I think for most people, when you think about going to the mission field, there's like a glamorous side, almost like a super spiritual people go and do that kind of thing. And, you know, it's really easy to get caught up into that, even as you try to raise money and you go. So we were at this church in Indiana, and I kind of presented what we were doing, and it was Sunday school class, and I kind of did my thing, kind of doing a Q&A afterwards. People are asking all kinds of good questions. And towards the end, a guy stood up, and he was angry. And he said angrily with his voice and even with his gestures, he said, "How can you do this to your kids? How can you screw up your kids this way?" And I thought, well, I'm going to screw them up anyway, so what, you know, what's the difference? How can you screw up your kids this way? You're going to rip them from what they know, the culture they know, the language they know, and you're going to screw them up for the rest of your life. How can you do this to your kids? Now, there's a little part of me that was like seething. But if you think about what's behind his question, it's the exact same question with Hudson Taylor. Is it a waste or is it worth it to do that very thing, to give your life that way? Which is it? Because I think the truth behind that is the question that is kind of behind a month like this. Why go to the mission field? Hey, there are plenty of unsaved people right here and unsaved people in Hastings, right? We don't have to go very many blocks, much less to a foreign field, to find somebody who needs the Lord. So why go to the mission field? Why give up your life that way? Why lose all the family time? Why go to a place where it's going to be lonely and hard? Why go into like the lion's den? And a lot of places in the world, you walk, as soon as you walk off that airplane, there's like a tangible, spiritual oppression kind of feeling. There's places like that. Why throw yourself into the mix there? Why would you do that when there's so much ministry here that could be done? And I bet it's a question you've thought about. And so in a lot of ways, what happens is we try to determine the value of doing such things. And so much of our life is a judgment call as we count the cost in value. And I want to give you a kind of a formula to think through what you value the most. And the formula goes like this. Value determines meaning, or how you decide what something means. And meaning then determines what you do. So value determines meaning. Meaning determines action. And very quickly, I want to show you how Paul walks through that in 2 Corinthians 4. So turn with me to 2 Corinthians 4. And we got to go. We got to fly. So don't dilly-dally. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And again, what we're looking for here is the value, meaning, action. What does he value? How does it change how he interprets and understands what life is, his life is going through, or what he's going through? And then how does that determine or direct his action? So 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7. I'm going to super fast read these verses here, but here we go, verse 7. It says, "But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way but not crushed, perplexed but not driven to despair, persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifest in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifest in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you." Verse 13. "Since we have the same spirit of faith according to what it has been written, 'I believe and so I speak,' we also believe and so we speak, knowing that he who raised the Lord Jesus will raise us also with Jesus and bring us with you into his presence. For it is all for your sake, so that as grace extends to more and more people, it may increase thanksgiving to the glory of God. So we do not lose heart. Though our outward self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day to day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. So, okay, we're going through the formula. Value determines meaning, or how you interpret what you're going through. And meaning then determines what your action is. Verse 7, he gives us right out of the chute here, he gives us the value. He says we have this treasure. This is what he values. And he says that the treasure is the power, it's the gospel. But then he goes on to say it's actually a little bit more than that. It's not just the gospel, but it's actually the glory of Christ. He says the same thing again a little bit later, that it's the glory of Christ which pushes him. In verse 17, this light momentary affliction, it's the eternal weight of glory, that it will be beyond all comparison. So what he values more than anything else is the glory of Jesus. It's the fame of Jesus. It's the honor of Jesus. And he sets his ultimate and highest value on the things of heaven, on the things of eternity, on Jesus and his power and his glory. He says, that is the greatest treasure I have. So his value is heaven. His value is Jesus. His value are these things that are beyond compare. He says that the unseen aren't very important, but the stuff that we're going to see someday, that is going to be beyond comparison. So in a sense, what he's saying is that he's going to value in his life the best, and the best is yet to come. And for all of us as Christians, we believe this is true. We believe that the best is yet to come. And that's why, in a sense, Paul says, all right, so if the best is yet to come and it's going to be someday in heaven, then what's the worst that man can do to me here? Man, if they kill my body, thank you, I get heaven. If they take everything I have, who cares? I get heaven. If they take away my family, they take away everything that means something to me, in a sense, who cares? I still get heaven. So his value, his greatest value, is heaven. And it's beyond comparison, he says. That's heaven. So in other words, he's saying, if I value my future in heaven, in the presence of God, and eternity there, more than anything else here, I have to live as if it's true. And not just say it's true. Now, quite honestly, it's easy to say it's true, hard to live it. I don't want you to think that he's just kind of, you know, saying like super spiritual talk or whatever, because starting in verse 8, he says, okay, here's my life. I'm afflicted, persecuted. I'm not destroyed, but I'm persecuted. I'm perplexed. So he goes through all of these words: persecution, despair, affliction, beatings, reputation, sickness, and death. Now, those are all really bad things, we would all say. But his point here is, those are all the things that matter here, but compared to the value of heaven, they don't matter very much. So, you know, they could take away everything I have, but they can't take what I treasure the most. So they can persecute me, they can torture me, they can do all these things, but in a sense, who cares? I get heaven. So the meaning that he ascribes to the suffering, to the heartache, to the persecution, to the torture, he's ascribing meaning to those things. And he says, compared to the value of heaven, these things aren't very important. Now the problem is that you and I, we fixate on these things. We fixate on our heartaches and our despair. We fixate on things that aren't going right, and we worry and we're afraid of the future and what's going to come and the next diagnosis and all of those things, and are our kids going to be screwed up? They are. It's okay. Don't worry about it. And all of that. And it's in part because we have the wrong filter. We're not filtering it through the ultimate value of heaven. We're only filtering it through what matters in the here and now. So what you value changes the interpretation of what you're going through in the here and now. And that's important because, you know, quite frankly, the life can just, you know, kind of crush over you. And you go through a lot of things. I'm just thinking the last 3 months, we've had a lot of people in our church go through a lot of things, hard things. You know, I was just talking to a man between services. He said, "My dad will die today. I am going from here to hospice, and my dad will die today." Now, that's a hard thing to say. But part of what Paul is saying is, yeah, that's true. But compared to eternity, what is death here for those who believe? And it changes the interpretation of what we go through when our true and our highest and our greatest value is heaven. And what that means is that every time we confuse the lesser things for the greater things, we're going to misassign the meaning and the interpretation and the value of these things. And we do this all the time. I'm so fascinated why one of the most repeated commands in the Bible is fear not. Fear not. What I find really interesting is that I think in our world today, there's a lot of fear. Fear for all kinds of things. And that's not to say, you know, the Bible's whole perspective is don't worry, be happy or something. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is the way we interpret what we're going through in this life changes when our greatest and our highest value is heaven. When we live for heaven, it changes how we see and we interpret and we cope with the here and now. Value determines the meaning of what we're going through. So then he goes on, verses 13 through 15, and he says, okay, so this is the action. Remember, value determines meaning, meaning determines action. In verses 13 through 15, we have the action. I don't have time to read it through all again, but basically he says, hey, this is why I open my mouth. This is why I speak. It's because my greatest value is heaven. What's the worst they can do to me here? So if I'm not afraid of what they can do to me here, that's why I go from city to city to city. I go into the synagogues and I go into the square. That's why when I open my mouth, I get into trouble. I kind of feel that way with Paul. I open my mouth, I get into trouble, but he does it for a different reason. He goes to these places and he speaks the word and they grab him and they stone him. Or they arrest him, or they throw him in jail, or they throw him out. And he says, who cares? Because I'm going to interpret what I'm going through based upon the value of heaven. So I'm going to open my mouth because they can't do anything to me here because ultimately what's going to happen? I get heaven. So he's making this constant value choice because his highest and his greatest value is heaven. And he says, the reason I do this is because I believe. And I think when Paul says, I believe, it's a little bit different than the way I say it. When I say this is what I believe, I tend to talk about like my spreadsheet in my head of all the things that I believe, my theology, my list of my beliefs. But I think when Paul says, I believe, he says, down in my guts, in my heart of hearts, I believe that heaven will make everything worth it here. And I think the principle here is that the depth of conviction makes all the difference in the world. You see, there are a lot of people that walk around, churches like ours, and they have a lot that they believe. And they're very happy to tell you everything they believe and everything you should believe. But I would so much rather have people of conviction than I would have people that can list all the right things to say and all the right things to believe. What we lack are people of conviction. Deep in the gut, heart of hearts, convinced that heaven is going to be for a long time and earth is just for now. So value determines meaning. Meaning determines action. And when we get the value wrong, we get the meaning wrong, and we get the action wrong. And I think that's why stories like this Hudson Taylor story inspire us. And when I read these books, and I love to read these books, and I mentioned last week I'm reading the book called God in the Rainforest. It's a story of Jim Elliot and his friends. They have guns in their pocket. The natives are coming at him. They're going to spear him to death. They could have shot him, shot them, saved their life, but they didn't. They literally did this, and they were stabbed, and they died. And you look at that, and you're like, what a waste of a life. Literally, Time magazine in 1957 or whatever it was, front cover, a waste of a life. Was it a waste of a life? And so we read these stories and we get inspired by these people who do these amazing things and we wonder why? What's behind it? What's the motivation? It's the value of heaven. It's a perspective that says eternity is long and life is short. So I'm going to live for the long. It's a question of value. So back to Hudson Taylor. Was it a life that was wasted or was it a life that was worth every effort? Was it worth it to bury four kids there? Was it worth it to bury two wives there? Was it worth all of the hunger and all of the despair and all the times in jail? Was it worth it when he was essentially thrown out of his own country and people called him a lunatic for going to China? Was it worth it? Well, along the way in his 51 years of service, he started 20 mission stations, brought 849 missionaries to the field, trained 700 Chinese workers, raised $4 million in the 1800s, and developed from nothing a Chinese church of 125,000. He himself probably led about 35,000 people to the Lord and baptized about 50,000. That's just him. When I was in Shanghai a couple years ago, talking to these guys, there were four guys that I spent the time with. All four had been beaten almost to death for their faith. I felt like what do I have to say to you kind of thing. I was just so humbled to be there. So I decided I thought it would be really cool to ask him about Hudson Taylor and the influence of Hudson Taylor. So he's back in like the 1850s, right? So it's 150 years later. Those guys, they welled up as they talked about Hudson Taylor and his ongoing influence in China. Did he waste his life or was it worth it? One way to look at that, Taylor was a doctor, and if his life had taken a different path, where would those thousands and probably millions of Chinese believers, how would they have come to faith? He wrote this famously. He wrote, "China is not to be won for Christ by quiet, ease-loving men and women. The stamp of men and women we need is such as will put Jesus, China, and souls first and foremost, in everything at every time, even life itself must be secondary." Again, easy to say. But then when he realized that he did literally his own life and the life of his family for the cause of Christ in China. Value determines meaning. Meaning determines action. So could it be that there are some here that have felt over the years, and maybe since their teenage years, a stirring to take a risk, to go somewhere, to go spend their life for Christ, to walk into those countries with the oppression, to go where nobody else would go. And all of your life you've resisted. You said it's okay for somebody else. No, it's too much of a risk. No, I have a family. No, it's going to be hard. How am I going to get all the finances lined up? What's going to happen to my kids? All of those questions. They're all very fair questions, but have you ever dealt with why you're being stirred to do it? What are you so afraid of? What are you so afraid of? What is the worst that man can do? What if they take your life? So what? You get eternity forever. What if they take your kids? Be hard, terribly hard. But I bet in heaven, you would say it'll be worth it. Value determines your meaning and how you interpret and you see life. And how you interpret and see life determines your action. And you know what? If you go backwards, you start with your actions and what they say about how you see life. And how you see life says about what you really value. What is it that you really value? Is it an eternity beyond compare? Is it the glories of heaven? Is it the fame of Christ? What is it that you value the most? And what are you so afraid of? Could it be that God might stir somebody here, sitting here right now, to say, man, I've felt this all my life. I've been afraid. I've stapled my butt to the chair and I said, I won't go, Lord. And I just want you to deal with this week, maybe today, with the question, what are you so afraid of? What do you so value that you would say no? Could God be calling you? So I dare you this week to risk a prayer that simply says, Lord, do you want me to go? I dare you. Ask, listen, and see what happens.